There's an area in the northwest Kimberling, a void that plunges down as deep into the earth as the Great Pyramid of Giza soars into the sky. It's the former Argyle Diamond Mine. Now, when the area was first being canvassed in the early 70s to see whether it might yield diamonds, teams of geologists and helicopters covered an area three times the size of Tasmania, the size of Victoria, and indeed the size of all of Great Britain. And yet few people believed that Australia would ever be a serious diamond producer, unlike, of course, the mines of Africa. And it is such an expensive and risky venture. Kimberlites is the name of the rock where diamonds had historically been found, and it's estimated that less than 0.1% of kimberlites discovered will yield enough to start a mine. That's a failure rate. Take notes, you'll be asked questions later, of 99.9%. Historian Stuart Kells has written a compelling history of Australia's diamond industry in a book called simply Argyle. Stuart's an adjunct professor at La Trobe and in the College of Art, Social Sciences and Commerce, and we welcome him back to the program. Given that failure rate, the men who believed they would find diamonds, or the man really, Ewan Tyler, must have had enormous faith.
Yes, Philip, it's pretty amazing. My wife, having read this book a few times in manuscript, she occasionally gets the urge to go out and look at creeks now and to sort of see whether she could try a hand at diamond hunting. And I know a few people have had that sort of reaction when they've heard the story, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. That's right. It's a pretty risky venture. And the way they did it, as you indicated in your introduction, they had to cover a very, very large area and what at the time was pretty remote country.
My memory goes back to the famous De Beers slogan, "A diamond is forever." That changed the perception of diamonds pretty much everywhere.
Yes, that's right. The history of diamonds is in large part the history of marketing and changing perceptions of diamonds relative to, you know, other gems and to gold. And to other things to buy. And obviously, over time, the coloured diamonds are becoming more popular as well.
The Argyle diamond mine was the result, yes, of a 10-year search involving all the stats are fascinating, 35,000 helicopter takeoffs and landings. And as you write, one find led to another. The West Kimberleys led to Ellendale in 76 and the East Kimberleys led to Argyle in 79.
Yes, well, some of those steps along the way are pretty important because it was a 10-year search. It started off in the late 60s and, you know, there was a series of milestones with finding tiny little mineral clues, the indicator minerals, and then finding the first diamond and then larger diamonds and diamond pipes. But then there was this massive find in around 1978 of the Ellendale diamond field, and there was a huge amount of excitement in the diamond search consortium and in the wider stock market, which led the diamond venturers to float part of their, you know, interests on the Australian stock market. And there was this sort of diamond mania. But it turned out that the Ellendale field wasn't economic for the sort of scale that those, the backers of the joint venture had in mind.
So but heavens above Argyle was, wasn't it? Because it produced up to 40 million carats per year. That's around 18 tonnes of diamonds, equivalent to 40% of world production.
And in order to get every one of those diamonds, for every diamond, there was 1,000 times as much rock that had to be moved. So it was a major undertaking. A diamond mine, even though you rightly point out that the Argyle deposit is the richest and most valuable piece of real estate on earth, it's also true that all the diamonds are wrapped up pretty tightly, or were wrapped up very tightly in rock. So it was a major enterprise to get them out.
Tell us about Ewan Tyler, because, you know, he's you rightly describe him as the father of our diamond industry, but and also about his dad, Harold.
You see, Ewan and his dad are really interesting as a bridge from what's essentially modern mining and scientific mining of today back to the era of the independent prospector and to those great mining houses of essentially the British Empire and the colonial era, so in Southern Africa and in India and Malaysia. And Ewan Tyler really grew up in that world. He spent a decade in various parts of Africa, including Tanzania and South Africa.
Take a deep breath there, because I love the fact that he worked for an outfit known as Tanks, which stood for the Tanganyika Concessions Limited.
Which itself has a really interesting birth right back in the days of, Cecil Rhodes and the royal family, and that really interesting sort of opening up of the diamond world in South Africa in the 19th century. So that family connection goes right back to those days. And Ewan had that 20 years either in London, 10 years in London and 10 years in various parts of Africa, but saw himself as Australian. He'd been born in England, but had gone to secondary school and university in Western Australia. So he was this, they sort of talked about him as the mad colonial, this independently minded Australian in these big English mining houses in the 50s and 60s.
The Pinjarra School for English Boys south of Perth must have been a bit of an odd place, because he learnt to pan for gold and learnt to love explosives.
Yes, one particular time he almost blew up the chemistry lab and himself in that period. That's right. But that was laying the foundation for love of Australia and for a lot of interesting connections with other Australians, but also an awareness of the mineralogy of Australia as well. And some of those early experiments that he was doing actually were, in areas where there were important gold discoveries later on, there were important iron ore discoveries, etc. So he was obviously very much the right place at the right time.
Talking about the right place at the right time, you talk about your wife going up and down creeks. I'm going to start doing that on the farm, because I learned from you that it was the Hunter Valley that once upon a time produced most Australian diamonds.
It's really interesting that whole story of diamonds on the East Coast. That's right. Most of the early diamond discoveries in Australia were from that area, and they were alluvial diamonds, so a bit like alluvial gold. They were found in creeks and close to the surface. And no one has really solved the mystery of where those diamonds came from. Some of them seem to have come from unusual sources deep in the earth, and some of them may even have come from meteorites and other sources. But they weren't, in terms of the scale we're talking about in Argyle, vastly smaller and very strange and anomalous discoveries.
Stuart, in my part of the world, it pays to look at the ground carefully. My neighbour at Alliston, the late Kerry Packer, was astonished to find that there were jewels all over his property, as though the old bugger wasn't rich enough. But they'd find sapphires and rubies and all sorts. You never know, do you?
That's right. And some of the early gold seekers and tin miners and others on the East Coast occasionally found diamonds and really weren't sure what to do with them. But when you find a rough diamond in the wild, they don't look anything like jewelers' diamonds. They're much simpler in shape, and they have a dull surface. So they're fascinating, the rough diamonds, but they do look quite different to what we're used to thinking of as gem diamonds. So a lot of them just didn't know what to do. And there were these great stories from the 19th century of these sort of bushmen and others walking into these remote homesteads carrying diamonds and not knowing what to do with them, which is very relevant to the Argyle story as well, because it's one thing to get the diamonds out of the rock, but what do you do with them next?
Tell me about lamproite, the discovery, the significance of the discovery.
Well, this goes back to Ewan Tyler's background in studying at the University of Western Australia under Rex Prider. who had a bit of a hunch, nothing more really than a hunch around the time of the Second World War, that some of the rocks in the Kimberleys, which were lamproite, were similar geologically to some of the diamond-bearing rocks in southern Africa. So it was really wasn't much more than a hunch, and not much happened as a result of that hypothesis, because it was in wartime, and Western Australia was still a long way away from having its great mining boom later in the century. So this was an idea that was working really in the back of Ewan's mind. And it wasn't until the 1960s, after the British possessions in Africa were shifting towards independence and other changes happening as well, that Ewan said, well, really, we need to think about opening up another continent. What about Western Australia?
I hadn't realised that De Beers of Diamonds Forever had an Australian arm which spent hundreds of millions also searching for diamonds in the Kimberley, but unsuccessfully.
That's right. That was Stockdale Prospecting. They searched all around the Australian continent, including in South Australia. And I think they did actually find one or two volcanic pipes, but weren't diamond rich. But yeah, really interesting, because part of this story is about the parallels between African geology and Australian geology, but also the differences. So De Beers and their explorers were very much used to the science and the geology of particularly southern Africa, and the Australian geology is quite different. And the way that those searches that were successful in the Kimberleys, the way they succeeded was using different kinds of methods and different knowledge around indicators and
well,
field methods.
Well, Tyler, inspired by the good Professor Prider, learnt to read the land and and study at a granular level, didn't he?
Yes, it's really interesting, because the scales in this story are huge, but the clues that they chased to find the diamonds were tiny, literally microscopic. Little bits of chromite and chrome diopside and things like that. These are minerals that are formed in the mantle beneath the Earth's crust in the same way and around the same areas as diamonds, but in larger quantities and greater profusion. So if you knew where to look in the creeks and the little niches, and you knew what you were looking for, and that knowledge was closely guarded. So some of the knowledge around indicator minerals was in the literature, but some of it was closely guarded by the searchers themselves, and it was about their own experience and their own sort of special knowledge.
One of my old mates in bygone days was Malcolm Muggeridge, and one of the geologists, Maureen Muggeridge, said it all had to be hush-hush. You couldn't say you were looking for diamonds, because that would spark too much interest. I felt like a character in a James Bond movie.
Yes, they spent a lot of time early on maintaining that secrecy, using code words and cover stories and sort of fake destinations and trying to maintain the cloak of secrecy. It was not entirely successful, and obviously later on entirely unsuccessful, when we had those the diamond mania on the stock market, where people just went and randomly staked out sheep stations and all sorts of things in case.
LNL on Radio National, talking to historian Stuart Kells, author of Argyle, The Impossible Story of Australian Diamonds, published by Melbourne University Press. Now, the Indigenous ownership of this land is a huge issue cover here, and I think you know that I got embroiled in some arguments about this when I was writing for The Age. Did the Indigenous people really grasp the true scale of a diamond mine in the region? It seemed to me that they were absolutely conned by the mining company.
There's a lot in that. So this understanding or not of the scale of the activity, the actual, the excavation and the works on the site, and then this understanding of the value of the deposit and having, obviously recognition of rights to that value. So now that's a really important part of this story. And there was great resistance among people like the Premier of Western Australia at the time, to the idea that Indigenous people would have a legal and an economic interest in mineral resources, which obviously they do and they should. But in political and some commercial circles, there was great resistance to that idea. So, and this obviously long predates the Native Title Act and all sorts of other frameworks for Indigenous rights.
I suddenly remember a column I wrote so many, many years ago trying to point out how totally bewildering the Indigenous population found the idea of diamonds' value. I remember quoting an Aboriginal woman saying, "What is diamond?" And someone explained to her that the tiniest little diamond was worth more than, well, a Toyota Land Cruiser, which was the sort of bribe that was on offer at the time.
Yes, that's right. And the site works as well. So the local people around Argyle, the people of Glen Hill and Turkey Creek and areas like that, didn't really have any sense that the diamond discovery had been made, or that the diamond, you know, search was underway, or that there was probing and testing of the pipe. And they didn't really sort of have any wind of this until they noticed, you know, excavation and these sort of trenches and things being dug around the pipe. And they contacted their, you know, the regulators and the universities and said, "What's going on?" And there was quite a lot of disturbance just from that. But that was, you know, trenches that are 1 meter deep, and you know, scarring the land. But in order to do them, to actually pursue the diamonds, the scale of the excavation was, you know, literally a million times larger. They would dig out literally millions of tons of rock and spread it out over a large area.
Sacred site, Stuart.
Yes, there was one very important site that coincided with the pipe. It was an important Barramundi dreaming site, and it was sacred to Gija and Mirawang women. And the destruction and loss of that site was obviously very, very important for the local people. And the in a sense, the negotiating away of that site as part of the economic development, which was incredibly, you know, obviously one-sided deal, that created a lot of bad feeling and sadness in the local community, and it was never actually repaired, never overcome.
There's ongoing environmental damage, you say?
Well, yes, it's a huge site remediation effort. They're going into that now. So the actual mining has finished. It finished on the day of the US election, the most recent one. And there's a bit of processing still going on at the site. So all of the machinery and that's still chugging away, processing the ore. That'll finish in the middle of this year. And then there's a very large effort to remediate the site. But as I indicated, the amount of tailings, it's vast. It's gravel. It's not like it's sort of radioactive or anything like that. But it is a huge area of tailings that creates these sort of terraced mounds all around the old mine site. So turning that back into something like natural land, it's going to be extremely difficult. And in the process of actually doing the mining, there has been damage to sites of coal and environmental significance.
Let's dwell on West Australian politics for a moment. At the back of the book, you mentioned that one of the investment companies asked naughty Charlie Court whether Indigenous people could be part of negotiations around the mine, which he rejected. What did Brian Burke do?
Well, yeah, good point. So a large part of the lead up to the mine, and this is in the early 80s, coincides with that WA Inc. era of, you know, Laurie Connell and all the kind of limousines and fast money, and essentially the when that government came in, they put a new requirement on the miners to essentially build a mine town at Argyle. This was an obligation that they didn't think they had, and they were quite resistant. The miners were quite resistant to the idea of having a mine town with you know, full service of schools and shops and all that sort of stuff, because partly they'd seen that sort of town in other areas of remote WA turn into, you know, very difficult places to live. But with the extra security and the extra burden of it being a diamond mine and all of the security and suspicion that goes with that. They just thought it would be intolerable. So their preference was for a fly-in, fly-out arrangement, either bringing workers from Bali or Broome or Perth, and ultimately they ended up doing it through Perth mostly. And so the quid pro quo from the government was, well, okay, well, we'll remove that obligation, but you give us $50 million. Suddenly going from already having a very significant mine royalty to working through that new requirement. And one thing led to another, and I think Alan Bond entered the picture and a few of those other, 80s entrepreneurs entered the picture. And that was, another hurdle.
That's a diplomatic term, entrepreneur. Laurie Connell and Alan Bond, heavens above. Look, I have to ask you about the pink diamond phenomenon. Mm. Did that require marketing to make pink desirable?
Yes, it did. The idea of those sort of fancy coloured diamonds was a very niche thing in diamond and jewellery circles. And quite early in the Argyle story, they were finding these pinks, other coloured diamonds as well, but the pinks were quite striking in the depth of colour and that sort of thing. And so they quite early organised these very glamorous tenders, which were these sort of exclusive events around the world, where people could put in, submit bids and acquire these very special gems. And so that became a real draw card around the world in the diamond industry. And now every year is probably bigger than the previous one. And the most recent one, which was the second last Pink's tender, was huge prices and a lot of interest. I think there's going to be one more, maybe.
What's the diamond price like around the world? Is it buoyant, booming?
This last 12 months, it's been spectacular. It has. Plus the sense that the Argyle mine is closing and that there's going to be fewer pinks around, those things together are driving real spikes. And some of these things, $1 million plus for what's essentially a small twisted coloured piece of carbon. It's pretty amazing.
I'm going to be heretical here. I've always found diamonds dead boring. I mean, I love opals. There's a whole variety of gems that I think are gorgeous, but diamonds, that's why a pink is probably preferable to the standard issue. But look, thanks for this and thanks for the book. As I said to you off air, I'm very glad that someone's got around to telling this fabulous and in many ways quite ugly story. Stuart Kell's book, Argyle, The Impossible Story of Australian Diamonds, published by Melbourne University Press. Thanks, Stuart.
A pleasure. Thank you.